Welcome to the Vinyl Draft Great Conversations podcast. Today's great conversation is with Ruth McIver. The Vinyl Draft Great Conversations podcast is all about books, writing, and literary culture. I'm Andrew Popel. Every week I broadcast Vinyl Draft from the studios of 2SER in Sydney. Vinyl Draft is dedicated to exploring Australian writing, from debut authors to household names. Every week we look into the issues that drive our storytelling and help you discover more from the books you love. These are the stories that make us who we are. 2SER broadcasts from the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. I'm recording on the lands of the Darug and Gunungurra people. I want to acknowledge the traditional owners of those lands and pay my respects to their ongoing connection to their lands. Ruth McIver is a Dublin-born, Melbourne-based writer. She won the 2018 Rich L Prize for an emerging writer. Today, she's joining us with her hotly anticipated new novel, I Shot the Devil. Reporter Erin Sloan returns to her hometown of Southport. Her dad's sick, and though they haven't always had the best relationship, he's her only family. This is no nostalgia trip, though. Erin's editor wants her to report on the notorious Southport Three, a group of teens implicated in a satanic murder in the 90s. Erin's going to write a story about the group and their legacy, but Erin is also part of the story. She hasn't told her editor that she was dating one of the killers. Will the past stay buried once Erin starts digging? So once again, join me as we discover Ruth McIver's I Shot the Devil. Welcome, Ruth. It's so great to have you here.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here.
Now, we have got an incredible discussion, I am absolutely sure, coming up. But before we get into it, I'm going to pop a content warning on what we're discussing, because I Shot the Devil contains, as so many 90s VCRs told me, violence and adult themes. It may get a little, intense. And if people maybe don't want that in their day right now, tune out. But let's introduce the book to help people figure it out. In I Shot the Devil, reporter Erin Sloan returns to her hometown of Southport. It's not a nostalgia trip as such, though. Erin's a reporter, and Southport is notorious as the home of the Southport Three, a group of teens implicated in a satanic murder in the 90s. Erin's there to write a story about the group and its legacy, but Erin's also part of the story. She was dating one of the killers. I was hoping we could start off with this genre that we now know as true crime. Because I Shot the Devil works with true crime conventions, things like an historic crime, the unfolding investigation, the blend of the first person and the archival narration. Erin's a reporter, and while she relies on the police at times, her investigation is wholly different to maybe a more traditional mystery. I wondered, have we replaced the detective with the true crime reporter in our search for whodunit? And I wondered also then, what does that mean in the broader sense of who we trust to find justice in the world?
Oh, that's such a good question. That really is. And I think, like, you know, obviously we did have and we have had the amateur sleuth in the crime genre for some time. But I think you're so right. There's like a new sort of subgenre emerging where the reporter is the person who seeks out exposing miscarriages of justice. And I think that has a lot to do with, say, you know, the Southport Three, as you could possibly guess, is a bit of a nod to the West Memphis Three. So, you know, a case where three teenagers were falsely accused of murdering little boys in Arkansas. And partly the reason why that they were accused was because of the way that they looked. They were outsiders, they were into heavy metal music, and they were accused of being involved with witchcraft. And that was in the early 90s, so satanic panic was still going on. Now, you know, obviously these men were going to just kind of, they were in death row, they were going to perish. And it was, you know, the documentary that actually ended up bringing their story to light and eventually like securing their release. And I think that documentaries and podcasts have been really pivotal in exposing these miscarriages of justice. And, you know, and even like in Australia, I can think of another example, like Estelle Blackburn with her book, The Age of Innocence, with John Button and Eric Edgar Cook's crimes. That was another, you know, massive kind of factor in what led to his exoneration. And, you know, so I think journalists really are being more trusted than, say, the police to uncover these cold cases and decades-long miscarriages of justice.
And while this may be slightly tangential, it's interesting also that we're seeing, especially over the last 18 months of the coronavirus and coronavirus reporting, a similar level of interrogation of who journalists are and what they stand for, and perhaps a suggestion that they may not be all that they suggest they are, because it has become so incredibly important, whether it be the coronavirus, whether it be exposés of sexual abuse in the Catholic Church. Journalists are the people that are bringing us news that we feel we can't get anywhere else.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I mean, even like, you know, when I studied, like, say, Gothic fiction and early detective fiction, and I think what's really interesting is that from, and this is what I kind of believe, from the roots of Gothic fiction, that's where detective fiction kind of emerges from. And I think the detective sort of almost has this demonic quality in those early, or like there's a sense of darkness about them, like in order for them to uncover the crime and to get into the kind of like, say, the murderer's mindset or whatever, they have to have aberrance within them too. So it's like they have to be super dark and they have to like have that side, like Sherlock Holmes, you fully see that. He's practically evil. So in a way, like the journalist emerging out of that genre is a new kind of evolution. And perhaps like they have to be a little bit wicked too, because they have to have like a ruthlessness to them. And like, you know, obviously it's a bit of a cliche of the journalist being kind of unprincipled or unscrupulous, but kind of like a terrier kind of like coming at you with the truth. So,
and we absolutely, like, we love it, we devour this sort of stuff. In your acknowledgements, though, you talk about the trauma that informed your writing of I Shot the Devil. True crime, though, it's big business and people are drawn to it.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that tension between trauma as entertainment?
Totally. I mean, I feel very conflicted about it. And I mean, that's kind of why I did a PhD in that field, because I feel incredibly conflicted about it. And, at the same time, I kind of acknowledge my own interest as being one of, you know, ghoulishness and being really interested in darkness and in those sort of things, and I definitely won't disavow that. But I also feel that it's very valid and very understandable, and it can be done in an ethical way, and it has the potential for all these great outcomes. Mm. So it's just really complex, I think. And I think it's got so much to do with intention as well as delivery. And then, you know, you've got things like, one thing that I'm really interested in is like how we perceive tasteful true crime, because like, you know, say I read a novel that was written, and I'm not going to name or shame or anything like that, because it's not my business, but I'm just interested in it, like, you know, from a kind of like ideas point of view, that it's beautifully written, it's you know, it's so tasteful in so many ways, but at the same time it enters the consciousness of the victims. And, you know, it's a cis male author who's entering the consciousness of three raped and murdered teenagers. And this book kind of went without a ripple of anyone suggesting that there was anything untoward or untasteful about it. But then say, you know, and I think that largely that's because of the literary, you know, in quotation marks, like style. But then, you know, also I think there's a gendered component to it too, because like say Emma Klein's The Girls, she really mutes the violence and she explores the dynamics and the psychology and really focuses on the women around the Manson family. She got some really crazy reviews where they were like, why are you writing about this ghoulish, horrific thing? You know, even though she's done this in the most tasteful manner that you can imagine. And also the crimes are significantly more historical. So that also seems to factor into it too. So it's sort of like we can talk about something, you know, like, you know, Quentin Tarantino made a movie recently about the Manson murders. It seems like now a significant amount of time has passed, but it's like, you know, a lot of it is about what is perceived as tasteful. And we're not really sort of looking at necessarily what's ethical.
I want to come back maybe to why we turn to true crime in a sec, but picking up on what you were just saying there, I noted there is a point in the novel where Erin, your protagonist, notes, all the boys came from violence, they were violence, all the girls were victims. And crime stories of every stripe have this dirty history of women wrapped in plastic and gruff male heroes riding in to save the day. Did you want to address this in I Shot the Devil?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I mean, there is a sense like, and this was probably my starting point of, you know, women kind of being prey animals in a sense, and Erin confronting that in herself and her own vulnerability and her own sense of peril. And she is surrounded by peril and whatnot. But yeah, I definitely did want to address that. That was a hugely important thing for me in the novel. But I mean, there are male victims too. It's just, it's sort of like how the men internalize and then externalize the violence and trauma that they've experienced and how women just internalize it and tend to abuse themselves, you know, say with eating disorders and drug addiction and suicide and that sort of thing. So whereas the males would tend to, you know, have the greater tendency to commit violent acts.
Yeah, it was, and it is really interesting. Sorry, just picking up what you were saying there, the ways that the violence seems to be consuming, as you say, of the women, whereas, you know, the male victims have sort of very explosive ends. We don't see that. We don't see that consumption, that eating away that really destroys over time.
No, that's right. It's very, and I think that's because trauma is really corrosive and it's sort of like, it is complicated and it is largely like, you know, in this day and age, pretty untreatable. Like if you have complicated or complex PTSD, the treatments, unless you're kind of following non-traditional medicine and stuff, they're not great, you know. And I think, you know, just if you look at studies and stuff like that, I used to work for the School of Psychology and Psychiatry for Monash. And I interviewed forensic psychiatrists and, you know, we talked a lot about child abuse and studies of children that had been abused and the outcomes as adults. And it's really, really terribly sad. With women, just so many of them ended in suicide, early deaths, you know, and incarceration for both, but largely more for men.
I wonder also, and I'm just going to riff on an idea you suddenly put in my head, but I know that true crime and true crime, whether it be podcasts, whether it be TV shows and the like, have incredible followership in female audiences. And I wonder, like, what do people go to it for? Because it feels like there's this cognitive dissonance in the need to call true crime true crime. Now, I know I Shot the Devil uses true crime tropes, but is a fiction. But we call true crime true crime, while crime fiction just enjoys the more prosaic crime. we have this strange sort of dissonance, but also we turn to true crime, or do you think we turn to the different genres for different reasons? Are we looking for something different?
I think with crime fiction there's a resolution in a particular way, and I think that crime fiction, and this is, you know, an idea that I studied in my research, and there's a theorist called Leanne Dodd. She talks a lot about crime fiction as a bibliotherapeutic means, because with this kind of arcs and sense of resolution, oftentimes there's justice at the end, and even if, you know, the reader is almost vicariously traumatized by events, they still have the resolution, which isn't really, it doesn't really happen in true cases of trauma, which is, I mean, not to sound bleak, but you know what I mean? There isn't this sort of like, and then I was fine. But say in true crime, I think there's something, for me at least, I feel that it's quite instructional. And I think like there is something also about us confronting our deepest fears. Like, recently, I've been on a total bender of the Chris Watts case, for example, which I kind of noted when it happened in 2018, but I didn't really, and I don't entirely understand why I suddenly started reading about it and just getting complete, or maybe I saw there was a show on Netflix and then I started kind of picking up all the books and audiobooks and everything. But I know why I'm hooked, and part of it is why everyone's hooked, you know, because there's this narrative of, you know, the perfect partner and you're sleeping next to this person who is plotting your murder. And psychopaths who look like a very ordinary person. I think that's everyone's deepest fear. And I think especially for women, there's a sense of, you know, domestic terror. Like, you know, what if the person that I love is like planning on killing me? and unfortunately, statistically, that is possible. So it's like, and we read these cases and we hear these stories, and I think that we need to kind of like learn more so that we feel armed.
I think one of the most traumatic things that I've seen and read in recent times was the miniseries, docu-series that they made of See What You Made Me Do, Jess Hill's Stella Prize winning. And yeah. I can see how true crime would be even a step removed from that, where it does give us that that kind of narrative distance and bibliotherapy that you just talked about.
I was just going to say, like, and this again, I don't want to sound judgy when I say this, because I think everybody, there's no kind of, you know, there's no moral judgment on this, but it's just an observation. There are a lot of true crime podcasts where I've just heard people discussing cases in this really, really casual kind of cavalier way, where it's like, it's almost like those people are kind of just like people they know, and it's like they're making jokes. And I find that really, really difficult, because it's almost like it's cutesy. Like, it's like true crime is cutesy, and it's like become like 1 o'clock and, you know, true crime. And it's like, hey man, that's like, you're like really not disguising anything with that. Like there's kind of just, it's like pure entertainment. And I struggle with that. That's one kind of aspect of true crime. And then there's obviously, you know, which I kind of draw upon in the book, there's those ridiculous kind of true crime documentaries where it's just super cheesy and you're learning nothing. It's just, you know, parroting media stories.
Yeah. Oh, so many different directions I want to take us in. I'm just sort of looking at my notes.
Yeah.
Look, I want to actually come back to I Shot the Devil. That's right. There's a book. You wrote this incredible book. The popular story in the novel that is painted of the 90s killings of the Southport Three, it tells of a satanic ritual and perversion that corrupted these good kids. And in Danny particularly, we have you know, he's got a real swim team rapist vibe about him. It also, though, I found that that sort of narrative, it links in with narratives of privilege and privation with so you've got the victim and the so-called kind of demonic leader of the group, Ricky Hell. He is a person of color. Did you want to tap into the ways that dominant narratives can be leveraged against marginalized groups, and in that sense, they prop up privilege?
Absolutely. Especially, you know, you're writing, and you know, this is of course the case with Australia too, but you know, a lot of the cases that I was reading about were American cases, and where I set the book in Long Island was where I lived in the 90s, where it was very, very, very obvious to me how racial privilege operated. And so I did absolutely want to do that because, you know, minority youth committing this crime who looked a particular way was going to be, you know, a great scapegoat. And yes, of course, someone like who's wealthy, who's got that exactly what you said, swim team rapist vibe, who comes from, you know, like a moneyed background, he's a white guy, he's going to get away with it. And the truth of the matter is that, you know, in so many of those cases, that's exactly what happens. It's astonishing to me, like, but that's the way it is. So it was definitely a conscious decision to do that.
It's really, and I think it's so amazing what you do and so really important that the discussion is had, because I mean, in all the types of reform that we think we might've seen over 30 years, one thing that isn't being reformed is the way we tell those stories. And it's not spoiling anything in I Shot the Devil to say that Danny did it. At the very early point, you established that he was convicted for his part in the killing, but we very then also quickly see that he enjoys a normal, in fact, above privileged life of a wealthy person living by the water. It seems like even convicted, that sort of white privilege lives out the white fantasy.
Oh, absolutely. 100%. And I mean, this book was very loosely based on a true crime. And one of the things that really intrigued me was one of the key players was actually acquitted. And, you know, I read an interview with him and he was so detached and so cavalier and so unaffected. And his life was the same and he lived on the island. And I just remember thinking, you know, wow, he just fully got away with it. And, you know, it's quite incredible. But, you know, he had a really, really great criminal attorney who's he's pretty famous, actually. So, yeah, I think that he was based very loosely on that character.
Yeah, wow. I mean, I guess I Shot the Devil doesn't go so much into it, but the what you just mentioned there about the power of being able to use wealth and privilege to just hire the right people, and again, what are lawyers other than people who know how to tell the story in the right way to get the results?
Totally. And, you know, this is the thing, like, you know, in Australia, this is, you know, this is just an absolute travesty. Like, you know, like you're an Indigenous youth and you get convicted of a crime, you can be in prison when you're like a child, pretty much. So, yeah, it's horrific. And I hoped to highlight that in the book. And, you know, obviously I don't want to spoil any of the twists, but there are twists surrounding that, obviously. So
let's go then to this whole, like, we can't spoil anything, but the book is also incredible with all of these twists. And one of the compelling aspects that I want to hook people on is the way that you write this, the way that you create these twists, and the way you work across a range of styles in unfolding the story. I particularly liked the way you had multiple competing narratives written by members of the Southport Three. And I just wanted to know, like, how did you get yourself into these voices and then create these different styles? Because, I mean, it ranges from your incredible narrative written from sort of the Erin first person point. Then we have Erin writing confessionals. Then you have kind of slightly bad novelizations from memory. Like, how do you go from writing well to deliberately writing kind of a little bit bad and encapsulate all of these voices?
Yeah, I think that was really fun, actually, to do like a melodrama, like, and you know, these kind of like highly suspicious sort of and I think also for me, what I really like, what I really enjoyed doing also was just creating textual dread, you know, like with texts and emails and stuff, because, you know, I'm very, as a writer, like, you're very attuned to that sort of thing. And, you know, we're in a digital age where we're getting narratives all the time. We're seeing text all the time, and, you know, you're hyper attuned and sensitive to it. And just how, like, say a text message with like an ellipsis for me can send me into a spiral. Like, what's that ellipsis about? With the voices, I had to work really hard to make sure that they were discreet, because it's really hard not to, blur voice. I think with most authors that I know that have done multiple perspectives, you know, agree with that. You know, you do have to make sure that you're not doing that. I mean, obviously I wrote them separately, but there is a little bit of kind of like ventriloquizing and invoking the character, which is, you know, just part of the kind of weird mystery and magic of creating characters who kind of really actually come to life and their voice really comes through. Like, it's like sometimes it does feel like a mystical thing, because you're just sort of like you're channeling a person.
Many of these characters are not sympathetic, as we come to learn. Yeah. But I would imagine having to be inside their head to write their narrative as they perceive it, you would have to develop some sympathy for them. Is that tough?
Yes, I think it is tough. And it's like, but at the same time, you've got to think about your villains and like think about them. What's the worst thing that ever happened to them? Or, you know, what's the damage that's happened in their life? What made them that way? And I think, you know, it's got a lot to do with like forgiveness and stuff too. And there are some characters that just won't get any sympathy. And I'm not afraid to punish I'm not afraid to punish the wicked in my books.
I noticed.
So cathartic, I've got to say. Yeah, but there are like, you know, it's I think it is challenging. But I think when you start to kind of like, and it's interesting because I'm doing a read-along at the moment, as in there is a read-along going along with my book. So there are people in different locations reading it, which is really exciting but also horrifying as a you know, someone who doesn't want to read their own work even. And watching and listening to their reactions to the characters that are unsympathetic is really, really fascinating. Like I'm seeing a lot of sympathy. Sympathy for Carol in particular, which I'm interested in.
Oh, really? I mean, it's such a rogues gallery. I was about to say I find her the least, and then I was like, no, wait, there's Steve. No, wait, there's Danny.
No, I think Steve's got to be the worst. I mean, that's just that's my feeling. But Carol is very unpleasant, I have to say. But I kind of like how unpleasant and like awful she is too on a level. I love the challenge as a reader of reading a book with an unsympathetic character and starting to feel almost like it's almost like you're being brainwashed in a weird way. You're like, damn it, like how am I suddenly kind of empathizing with them? Or, you know, and that's like, you know, that's what happens if it's done well, I think. So hopefully I did it well, you know. It's always hard to know. And like, I guess that's where, you know, hearing readers, you know, tell me how they feel. It's just wild. I love it.
And so you just got me thinking now. I'm like, Steve, I think if you were to just dot point Steve's evil, yeah, you could make a compelling case for him being the absolute worst. But as I thought about it, I was like, there's something about the competition between Steve and Danny where Steve's almost like he's evil, but he's pulled himself up by his bootstraps evil. He did a lot of what he did because he didn't come from the same sort of privilege as Danny, whereas Danny's just kind of like, I'm going to be evil and I don't even have a good reason. Like, I could just live a comfortable life. I'm going to be evil because I chose to.
I met a lot of those kind of bros the area where I lived, which was like, an affluent area in Long Island. And there was a lot of those kind of, that type of masculinity on display. Interestingly enough, when I was living there at the time, you know, the Amy Fisher case where it's, she was called the Lethal Lolita.
Ah, like it sounds vaguely familiar, but I
don't. Yeah. I mean, it's such a great, a great nickname to have. But there was like telemovies made about her, like Drew Barrymore played her, Alyssa Milano played her. So it was like these different, in two different versions. There might've been a third version with a lesser known actress. It was a huge, huge case. She actually became a porn star.
Okay.
And she was like, she became, you know, internet famous. So she was like a teenager who went to the high school that my brother went to. She was in the same year or maybe a year above him. And I wasn't yet in high school there, but that would be the high school that I would go on to for a year. And so she was like a 16-year-old girl, had an affair with a married man who was her mechanic. And she tried to knock off his wife and she shot her and she, you know, did a lot of damage to Mary Jo Buttafuoco. She ended up, the case was just huge. It was absolutely, enormous. And my brother and his friends were all being interviewed and stuff. One of my brother's friends drove her past the house when she was like casing out the house.
Oh my gosh.
And like a lot of his friends, like I met at the time, they were these kind of guys, you know, like affectless, privileged, there was just so much toxic masculinity in that time and also that place. So yeah, like I was like observing that as like a preteen girl and then kind of just storing it away for later use.
Wow. So where does that leave us then? Because you've sort of just mentioned that privilege, even if it doesn't reach the level of kind of evil and violence is there. You were talking about in your book, you're not afraid of a little bit of just desserts. And to be, to be perfectly honest, I'd be staying away from sharp blunt force trauma implements if I were in Southport. But we've also talked about how one of the aspects of true crime is, unlike mystery, it doesn't have that neat denouement in the conservatory of an old manor house type of ending. Do you think that uncertainty, is that something that we just now have to live with as part of our modern condition?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, like, I really didn't want a neat ending in a bow because I don't feel that that's the way that, yeah, that true crime plays out. And, for example, with the West Memphis Three, while they were released, they had to sign something, which meant that they never really got acquitted of the crimes.
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, I know that Damien Eccles wrote a book after his experience, and I used to follow him on Facebook when I was on it, and I read his posts coming out of prison, and he suffered such intense trauma, and he was in prison, you know, since he was 18, you know, and he's like my age. And I just feel like so yes, there is some kind of resolution. There is some form of justice, but it's totally imperfect and it's not going to be neatly resolved. And I feel like I wanted it to be satisfying for the reader, though, because I didn't want it to be too bleak, but I wanted it to be real.
It brings me back to one of the first questions I asked about, you know, that difference between the genres of crime and true crime and why we turn to them. And maybe in writing a crime fiction about in a true crime style, maybe you're giving us something like the best of all worlds, because we can take the distance, but we can also take the uncertainty and if we choose, bring some sort of resonance and tie it up a little bit for ourselves. Like, you can get to the end and Erin gets to go home with her cat and we can feel a little bit okay about that. I fit the cat in somewhere in the end there.
Yes, Mister is fine to anyone who wants to know. Everyone gets to keep their cat and everything's safe. Mm. But, yeah, she does get to and I think there is some sort of resolution or, like, okay, so she's not going to go on, like, flat tummy tea and, like, become a fitness fanatic perhaps, but, you know, she's going to have some kind of resolution in her mind. And I think, yeah, that's really good to know that it, you know, it can have both of those tropes and so you can get that kind of true crime trauma, but then the crime fiction resolution. Also, you know, I wanted things to be, I like to leave a little bit of space for people to kind of, like, imagine and also make their own conclusions. Like, you know, I don't want everything to be so cut and dry and be like, this is this and, you know, spoon feed everything. I like to create some sort of, you know, some places for the reader to enter and kind of, like, draw their own conclusions and, you know, make up their own parallel storylines, which I'm seeing in the read-along, which is really cool. And sometimes I'm like, oh, wow, why didn't I think of that? Why didn't I do that? So
I'll tell you mine after we finish the interview proper.
Okay.
I am speaking with Ruth McIver. Her new novel, I Shot the Devil, is an absolute powerhouse. It's, you know, I'm in lockdown and it just took me away for a week. And
oh, so good.
I love that you've done that. Ruth, thank you so much for coming on Final Draft.
Thanks so much, Andrew. I love speaking to you.
That's it for this great conversation with Ruth McIver. Ruth's new novel is I Shot the Devil. It's out now from Hachette. Great Conversations is recorded on the lands of the Darug and Gunungurra people. The show is produced and presented by Andrew Popel. Now, I want you to stay in touch, but I also want to let you know I had the most incredible conversation with Ruth, and there are some outtakes. I'm going to release them in a part two. They are spoiler-heavy outtakes. Very funny, lots of cats, lots of Guns N' Roses references, but if you haven't read I Shot the Devil yet, approach part two with caution. You can find Final Draft on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Just look for @FinalDraft2SER. Subscribe in your podcast app. You'll get part two as well as all future great conversations every week. My name's Andrew Popel. I will be back next week with more great conversations from Final Draft. Till then, happy reading. Bye now.